period, Basil raised the question of how does one enter in and lay hold to the new covenant in view of the staggering nature of the promises of the new covenant. We had several weeks in which we talked about how lousy the old covenant was, how weak, ineffective, temporary, failing, and all that. And then we've had these marvelous statements about the new covenant and what it offers us. And Basil raised this question about how can we who are guilty and frightened and weak and failing be so bold as to go into the Holy of Holies and lay hold of all these wonderful things that God offers under the new covenant. And I thought about that question all week, and I don't really have an answer. I was going to maybe write up something, because this is the big gap for us to bridge, is how to begin to get acquainted with this God who is so lofty and so powerful and offers so much to us as a package, our wholeness, our fulfillment, the total forgiveness of all our sins. If you have any thoughts on that, let me know. Also, we have two more weeks after today, and if you have any questions on the last week, let's particularly go through the whole book with anything that remains very much unresolved. I am interested in the practical part of how we make this all work in our daily lives. Today we come to chapter 11. The chapter division's in the wrong place as usual, so put a big X right through the 11. And we probably should move the chapter division back, maybe to like verse 35 of the previous chapter. Let's see if that makes sense if we start with chapter 10, verse 35, which is a therefore. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. He's appealing to us to continue on the journey of faith, to have confidence in light of these marvelous things that God has done, and particularly also Jesus in his role as the pioneer of our faith, as the trailblazer, as the high priest who's interceding and leading. Do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. You have need of endurance. That fits this whole theme of Hebrews as a journey with a goal in mind. You have need of endurance so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. Then this quote from Habakkuk, which is used three times in the New Testament. We talked about that. Yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not tarry. The just shall live by faith, and if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to destruction, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. This little section came right after warning number 4 in the book of Hebrews, the warning against apostasy, against deliberate sinning, against not taking God seriously, not embarking on this journey, dropping out by the wayside. It's one of those, and here he's telling us to persist, to hang in there, to endure. This paradox of the salvation is a gift. When you came to know Jesus, the whole package was delivered to you, and it's all true. You're saved and sanctified and justified. And the whole thing is looked at as if it was a finished package on the day you first believed. But from the human side, we're encouraged to dynamic salvation into a day-by-day relationship with Jesus, into a deliberate course of adventure which runs contrary to the culture in which we live and contrary to a bunch of other things. And that's the subject of chapter 11 here, which is about faith. The whole book of Hebrews is all about faith. But now we're going to get some examples of people who lived before we did under the old covenant, and yet who were men and women of faith, and they were faced with the same difficulties that we are faced with in many cases. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That verse is full of a little bit of ambiguity and quite a bit of rich meaning. Faith gives us the assurance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith allows us to lay hold of things that are going to be true in the future and make them real now in the present. So we can lay hold of eternal things, appropriate them, and they can be ours today. Faith believes what God has said and acts on that in spite of circumstances. Barclay points out that in general, faith is going to be a set of actions that go contrary to the culture in which you live, contrary to the way the rest of the world lives. So you're going to look weird and strange when you do the crazy things that faith asks of you. people are going to wonder why you're running across the current of what's logical in the culture. Faith is very often going to be contrary to your senses and to your emotions. You're going to have to do things that don't make sense to your heart sometimes. I think you're probably well aware of that. When you're tempted to do something that you know to be wrong and you want to do it with your whole heart and you say no to that temptation because you know what God thinks about that and you know the futility of giving in to sin, and yet you're fighting with your whole being to give in to the momentary pleasures instead of the path of obedience. So very often your faith is going to act against all that you feel like in your heart. Faith is going to choose the future instead of the present. William Barclay points that out. You're going to look towards the long-term goal and not think about your present circumstances, trials, difficulties. That's not the way Silicon Valley lives, of course. Silicon Valley lives for the new BMW next year and the nicer house up in the hills and the higher status in the company and more worldly status in today's fulfillment and not the fulfillment in the grand future. And the nature of faith is to look to what God's going to do in the future, no matter how far off that might be or how hard our circumstances are right now. F.F. Bruce points out that faith is like the title deed. Somebody gives you a title deed and hands you the title to a piece of property. Well, that property is guaranteed to be yours before you go take possession of it. Bruce also points out that faith gives you an assurance. It gives, once you have trusted God for something, even though it's scary and risky, then you will see after the fact, you'll see that God responded to your faith, and so faith grows as you act on it. Every time you take a step of faith, God will show up and he'll confirm his reliability, and so next time it'll be easier to trust him for a little bit more. But there's always a risk involved. Now, I've gaining the conviction that churches tend to run on autopilot, that Christians tend to run on put the cruise control in place and just go through life without really having to trust God. We talked about that when we talked about the subtlety of the old covenant and the flesh and the subtlety of doing things that you're good at doing. You don't need God to help you out with this one because we're all practiced and experienced now. We've all been Christians a long time, so we know all the ground rules, so we'll just quietly go about living our Christian lives and hope that we're doing reasonably well. Well, in that mindset, there's no more faith left. You're not trusting God for hard things, for difficult things, for new things. You're not on the cutting edge. You're not really very useful to God. So that's very much all in the first verse here. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Ray Stedman always pointed out that believing is seeing, not the other way around. You know, we live in the seeing is believing thing. And it's believing is seeing. If you believe God and act, then you will see. The confirming evidence that you're looking for comes after you have acted, not before. You know, you have a lot of people who will ask you, well, I'll do the will of God as soon as I know what it is. Well, it doesn't quite work that way. You go do what you think is the will of God, and then he'll show you afterwards that you did the right thing. And if you didn't do exactly the right thing, he'll put you on course. So that's the part about faith, is trusting in an invisible God. And when you do that, God responds, and he will confirm in your daily life those invisible, unseen realities. He'll show up every time. And once again, you can see then that just simply sitting in church and absorbing truth and not acting on it is dangerous, as we've already talked about a lot here. That it's the acting on faith, it's the trusting God that he rewards. By faith, the elders, or the ancients, obtained a good testimony. Now he's going to take us back to the very beginning of history, and he says, all the way down through human history, it is faith that God has looked for. Forget about all the covenants and all the specific relationships people had with God. What God always wanted was trust. If you come to God out of any culture, any background, and you put your trust in God, and you call out to him for help, and you know that you need him, he'll show up. And so all down through history, there have been people who said, I'm going to trust God on this. I don't have a lot of knowledge, a lot of evidence, but I'm going to take a step of trust and believe that God will act. Well, that's what the ancients did. It says, by faith, the ancients, the elders, obtained a good report or a good reputation with God or were acceptable to God. By faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God so that the things which are seen were not made out of things which are visible. That's a very important verse. That's the word worlds here is the word for eons or ages. So this verse can mean all the ages of history were framed by God, and He has planned all of the course of human history and is directing it towards the final goal. In spite of all of our daily decisions which influence the general tenor of life, there's an overall plan for all the ages. Well, it means actually means more than that. It means that by faith we perceive that God created the whole universe, that everything that is sprang into existence out of nothing. The worlds were framed by the Word of God. Remember, we have two Greek words for word. We have logos, the whole Word of God. We have rhema, and it's rhema is used here, the sayings of God. God spoke the world into existence. It's by the speech of God, or Aslan singing, if you'd prefer the Narnia version. Aslan sang the world into existence. Jesus spoke the universe into existence out of nothing. So this verse is confirming John 1:1, and it's confirming Genesis 1:1, that the whole world and all of human history and the whole course of events was brought into existence by an invisible God who spoke things into existence and who is directing the whole course of human history by His Word. The things that are seen in the visible world were not made out of other things in the visible world. This sort of shoots down scientific naturalism and humanism and in the things that the modern philosophies that say that everything that is can be explained by natural means, by natural mechanisms that are within the realm of science. That's nonsense. It doesn't work that way. Everything in the visible world has an invisible counterpart. We already saw that with regard to the tabernacle. The tabernacle was a copy, a shadow, made after the real temple, which is in heaven. We could carry this so too far. We could, as Plato's concept of ideas or forms, that the world is a complete visible a bunch of shadows, and the real things that exist are all invisible. It doesn't exactly mean that, but it does mean that we're living in a world of derived realities. We're sustained by an invisible God, by an invisible realm. We're surrounded by angels. Things that happen in the ordinary world are not explainable terms in natural terms of natural humanism or materialism. Paul says elsewhere in the New Testament that the things that are visible are temporary and fading away. The things that are invisible are permanent. C.S. Lewis in The Great Divorce reminds us sort of in a fictional way that we're ghosts and shadows, and if we were to go to heaven now, we'd be smudges of smoke and the grass would hurt our feet and we'd find that we weren't nearly as solid and substantial as the people who already lived up there on the outskirts of heaven. And I think that all sort of fits in with verse 3. There's an invisible world of reality all around us. Now, the faith is allowing us to see into that invisible world and see the eternal things that never change, the God who never changes, lay hold of those realities and make them ours today. But we don't have to be caught up then in the visible things of the world. There's a contrast always in the New Testament between faith and sight, between walking by faith, not by sight. Walking by sight means to look at your circumstances and be logical and figure out a solution based on your logic or your previous experience or just upon the things that are plain to your common sense, perhaps. And faith doesn't do that. Faith reaches a hold and says, now, what has God said about this? What's God want me to do? And acts then in spite of what the circumstances might say. Biblical faith, by the way, is not blind faith, and it's not existential. There's a lot of people that are willing to live by kind of existential faith, which is sort of blind leaps in the dark of just flying by the seat of your pants and just taking life at one risk after another. Biblical faith is grounded in who God is and what He has said. So we don't just make wild choices of faith. That we think things through. We look through the Bible. We see what God has promised, what He has said no to, and we act according to that knowledge. When you start out, you may not know very much about God. When you're a brand new Christian, you don't know very much about God, but you trust Him anyway. He shows you more. So the course of the Christian life then is growing by learning more, by applying your knowledge, by refining your motives. We've talked about all those things. Now we're going to get some examples. This is a wonderful long list of people. And I've always noticed that in this long list here in chapter 11, a whole bunch of good things are said about a bunch of wretched people. because the real life stories of these people, which tends to be fairly unedited back in the Old Testament, they were a bunch of goofballs and failures, and they did some awful big blunders that you and I would never think of doing ever. And yet here they're commended. They're commended very highly, and the record of them is shiny, clean, and pure. And that's sort of nice, that when we get to glory, the records are all kind of edited and tidied up a little bit, and you'll come up there with a shining with a good reputation and a good character, and people will not pay much attention to your slip-ups along the way. Starts way back with Adam and Eve. Now, if you think that Genesis is historical myth and it didn't really happen, then you'll have a little problem with the very next verse, verse 4, which takes us to Abel. Cain and Abel. Adam and Eve had two sons, Cain and Abel. And if you go back and read the account, you'll find that it came around at the time of year when it was appropriate for Adam's family to gather and to thank God and to offer God some sacrifices based on God's blessings to them. And both these boys offered sacrifices to God as their father had asked them to do. And Cain was a farmer, and so he brought in the produce of the field. And Abel was an animal husbandman, and so he brought in some live animals. And so from outward appearances, they both were making acceptable sacrifices to God. But the scripture says very clearly that Abel's offering was accepted and Cain's was not. Now, I don't think that Abel's offering was accepted because it was a blood sacrifice. That's really not the issue. The issue we find out later, if you look, for example, in 1 John, you'll find that Cain was an unbeliever, actually, that his religious sacrifice was hypocritical, that the motives of his heart were wrong, that he was envious of his brother Abel, who was righteous. And so the basic issue here was one of faith. Cain was a man of the world and of the evil one, John says. And so his sacrifice didn't count with God. It wasn't offered in faith. And Abel's sacrifice was offered in faith. That got Cain very angry and jealous of him, and Cain killed him. So we have the first murder in history. So Cain had a real short lifetime, didn't have time to write any books or do any great, wonderful, heroic deeds. And so he died just a young man. And here, now centuries later, we read about his faith is still testifying. By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice, because his motives were right, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and through his faith he still speaks. Long after he's dead and gone, his faith still speaks to us, and God still honors his faith. He was righteous by faith. God bore testimony of his approval to that and still does all the way down through history. So that's the basic example here. Abel was a man of faith who trusted God, who saw beyond the externals of religion and entered into a relationship of love. And it isn't the gift itself. Remember the widow's mite who put in this half penny, and that was more than anyone else had put into the treasury, Jesus said. So it's the nature, not the quantity of the gift or the type of the gift, as so much as it is the motive of the heart. Now we jump. We're still before the flood. We're right in early human history. Oh, 7,000, 5,000, 7,000 years ago. By faith, Enoch was translated from Hebrew into Greek or something. I don't know. By faith, Enoch was translated so that he did not see death. And he was not found because God had translated him. For before his translation, he had this testimony that he pleased God. Elsewhere, we find out that Enoch was the seventh from Adam, seven generations after Adam, on the way to 10 generations to Noah. And I think those are probably literal generations. And the time period would be 1,600 to 2,200 years, something like that, is going to be the time period before the flood, during which the time the world population, by the way, built up to probably some billions of people, in all likelihood. And Enoch is a very interesting person about which there's a lot of fascinating apocryphal literature written, Jewish literature, and the two apocryphal books of Enoch, and there's a lot of weird and wonderful things that are mentioned about him, sort of like with Methuselah we talked about. When he was, remember, people were living up over 900 years before the flood, and he came along and he just departed at age 365, pretty young. And he just disappeared. He just didn't die. Something profound happened in his life when he was 365. God spoke to him and told him he was going to have a son, and his son was going to be named Methuselah. And there was something that went along with the naming of that son. When your son dies, by the way, the flood's going to come. So here's this little boy, Methuselah, with worried parents, afraid this little kid's going to run out in the street and get run over by a chariot or fall off a cliff and kill himself, and then the flood will come. Well, instead, he lived to be the oldest man that ever lived, 969 years, but the year that Methuselah died was the year the flood came. So here's Enoch, who got this big jolt when his son was born, and he thought, oh my gosh, I better start paying attention to God. And he paid attention to God so carefully and so faithfully, and he walked with God so reliably that God said, just come right on home, took him right on home, apart from death. As God also did with Elijah, and giving for us a picture of the translation of the saints at the rapture. If Jesus comes this morning in the patio and shows up and takes us all home, then we will go right straight into heaven and be transformed on the way, and we won't have to die. That's the whole idea in being translated. Getting our resurrection bodies right up in midair, and everybody else left behind. Be sure and read Time magazine this week. Make sure you're not going to be left behind. Okay, so this is Enoch. And so Enoch's faith pleased God. His life was shortened because he went home early. And what a wonderful example. Of course, we've already seen this in Hebrews, that if you walk close to God and you're right behind Jesus and Jesus has gone through the door of death, you don't have to worry about death and dying. It has no power over you, and the fear of death is banished away in Christ. You don't have to be afraid of that, but it would be sort of nice to be translated. Verse 6, without faith, it is impossible to please God. Not difficult. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. He who comes to God must believe that he is who he says he is, he has this character that he declares that he has, he rewards those who seek him diligently. Now that's true not just when you go to the Billy Graham Crusade and ask Jesus into your life the first time, that's true every single day for the rest of your life. Trusting God, acting on what he says is true, relying on him. The word faith is the same word that's translated belief in from the Greek, and it's a strong word. Believe and act and trust and rely upon strongly. Lean your whole weight on Jesus. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. This is if you go on autopilot. If you're running life and doing all the things that you're good at doing, and it's all in your natural strength, then that's not faith anymore. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to labor and struggle and stop and examine everything you're doing and saying, oh my gosh, I think I'm not doing this in faith, because a lot of things do become sort of natural to you when you're good at knowing and trusting God and you have this intimate, close relationship with Him. Well, then it's no, you don't have to sit and fret and worry about, am I walking by faith? You just do it. But this is a reminder of the constant trusting, relying, looking to God for the guidance and the instruction and the marching orders. What is it you want me to do today, Lord? Do you want to make a change in my plans, my itinerary, my giving, my lifestyle? What do you see that needs to be done here in Silicon Valley that I could take part in? I came to serve you, so you have to tell me what to do, and I may not want to do it, but I'm willing. And I'm willing to be made willing if I'm not. And we often don't want to do the will of God, but He will help us to do that. He rewards those who seek Him diligently. Sometimes knowing what God wants requires a lot of exercise in prayer, in asking for advice, in seeking, studying the Word, searching, pursuing God. God likes to be pursued. He likes to have people interested in Him and curious about Him and wanting to learn and grow. And you can ask God your real hard questions. I used to, when I was a new Christian, I used to keep a 3x5 card. I still keep 3x5 cards. I never read them. But I used to put all my hard questions on a 3x5 card so that when I ran on to Ray Steadman, I could ask all my hard questions. And he'd answer them, of course, and then I'd go away happy. But every time I saw Ray Steadman, there was always something that he had to say or that came up, and I never got my hard questions answered. And then I thought, well, I might as well just ask God those questions. So I did. I got in the habit of sort of asking God. I just posed the question to the Lord about these things that I didn't understand. And then He doesn't answer back instantly, you know. That a week later, you'll be stumbling along in the Psalms, and there will be the answer to your question. Or you'll get some little insight in the middle of the night, or circumstances will change, and you'll say, oh my gosh, now I understand what my question was all about. Well, this is the nature of faith. It's adventuresome. It's there's discovery involved. There's this sense of a big, marvelous unknown out there, and we're pushing back the curtains and looking into this big, invisible realm with a great, wonderful God. That's the whole idea, to seek and pursue and enjoy the pursuit of God. By faith, now we're going to jump to Noah, 10 generations from Adam, and the flood. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, preparing an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Noah is the first man in the Bible that is called righteous, that is said to be righteous. He was righteous by faith like everybody else, like we are. Noah was warned. Remember, in Genesis it said that God warned everybody that in another 120 years he was going to intervene and judge the world. And Noah had that sort of 100-year lead time. And at the age of 500, he got his young sons and started working on this big boat. Might have taken up to about 100 years to build this immense boat. Huge boat. You can go back and read about it. And on dry land, in a country where it didn't rain, where there was maybe heavy mist or dew, as far as we can tell, probably long ways away from any lake, and he didn't have a boat trailer, and it just sat there in his driveway. And the CNN would come by and talk about crazy Noah, and the neighbors would show up and laugh and ridicule at this crazy guy, and Noah would sit down politely and say, you know, God loves you, and there's this place of safety and refuge, and you and your family and friends should plan to come into this big boat. There's a lot of room for you. It's a luxury hotel, floating hotel like we now have. And come on in. We have a bunch of animals, but it's going to be comfy. Come on in. Bring your family and friends. And that went on for, say, maybe 100 years. And it finally came on to get time to get on board, and only 8 people showed up. Noah, his 3 sons, and their wives. And out of all the whole population of the world, well informed that this was going to happen, nobody would go. Well, that's a picture. Of course, Christ is our ark. We have today the job of inviting people to come into Christ, into the place of safety. There's coming a time when the ark will be lifted up and taken out, and everybody else will be judged. By the way, I should say about Enoch that Enoch was a great preacher and a great evangelist. We can infer that. And Enoch says that he had a great vision of the second coming of the Lord, that he actually saw the Lord coming way down beyond the time in which we live. So the world was well informed and well evangelized before the flood. The same appeal of the gospel, of God's love, went out to that whole world, and you end up with 8 people getting on board this place of safety and leaving. That's pretty startling. And Noah, now look what Noah's faith did. He condemned the world. Boy, that's a heavy-duty thing. Can you imagine that? The crazy little things that you're doing today and your trust of God that don't make any sense to anybody are actually bringing condemnation and judgment on all the unbelievers around about you, and that you are an heir of that righteousness which comes by faith, that there's a big inheritance being accumulated while you're spending all your money on this boat and all the family savings and enduring the ridicule and scorn of everybody. You're doing what God asked you to do, and that's what pleases God. Okay? We're going to jump down now quite a while after the flood to Abraham, because he becomes the great example. All the way through the Bible, Abraham is the example of the man who walked by faith. And we are all Abraham's children. All who have faith are the sons of Abraham. It's clear that the kind of faith that Abraham had was faith eventually, ultimately, in Jesus. Jesus said that as much, that Abraham believed in me, and Abraham saw my day. And so the faith that Abraham had was specific. It wasn't generalized biblical faith. It got to be specific and personal. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out of the place where he would afterward receive as an inheritance. He went out not knowing where he was going. Abraham was 75 years old. He was in the line of Shem. He should have been the one who had inherited the promises from Shem and knew the Bible, that part of the Bible that then existed. He should have known that he was in the line of promise that would lead to the Messiah. He'd forgotten that. His father had forgotten that. They were living in idolatry off in Iraq, in Ur of the Chaldees. And at age 75, somehow God spoke to him and called him. Didn't probably give him a lot of information and told him to get up and leave at 70, He was 70 when he first got a call. By the way, if you want a quick summary of the life of Abraham, Stephen gives that in his wonderful speech in the book of Acts. You can read the summary of this. Anyway, he headed out for this unknown land, taking his wife and family and animals and tents and supplies, journey 400 miles or so, long journey. And he believed that God was going to meet him there and that he ought to be acting on this impulse, this vision that he had. Didn't have the whole Bible, didn't understand it, but he acted. Every time he made the right choice, God confirmed it and finally gave him a great series of promises as a result of his repeated acts of obedience. 25 years later, we see him at the age of 100 and his wife Sarah at the age of 90, still waiting for the promise of a son that God had promised he would give him. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise, that's Israel, what is now Israel, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. There are his sons Isaac and Isaac's son Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, who became the head of the patriarchs of Israel. And living in tents, that means that making their living by farming and by the care of animals who grazed, and so they had to move around to get good grazing land from time to time, but no fixed place to live. They didn't settle down and build cities. He waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Now, this is absolutely profound. If you think about why did Abraham go to this unknown land and homestake a new way of life for himself at great risk, taking care of this big entourage of servants and animals, what was he believing that God would do for him? Did he believe that God would make him rich, famous, and successful? No. That God would make a great movie out of his life? No. That he'd end up as a Middle Eastern Bedouin tribesman, a big chief with a whole entourage? No, he didn't think that. He saw beyond all that worldly stuff, and he said, there's a city. I'm looking for a city. And that's really quite an amazing thing. It wasn't the land that he was interested in. It was this vision of a city that we're still looking for, the New Jerusalem. Imagine that. That's really staggering. If this wasn't in Hebrews, you'd never believe it, would you? He waited for the city which has foundation, whose builder and maker is God. There's a heavenly city where we're all going, all of us who live by faith. It's a big, marvelous city in the book of Revelation. Now, verse 11. This is not well translated in our Bibles. And I'll give you F.F. Bruce's translation, verse 11, which is a little more accurate to the Greek. By faith, he, that is Abraham, also, together with Sarah, received power to beget a child, even after the natural season of life, because he reckoned the one who gave the promise to be trustworthy. What this really says, what verse 11 says, is that at the age of 100, Abraham was sterile, incapable of producing a child, and Sarah was past the age of bearing children, so both of them were incapable of bearing children. Both of them, not just Sarah. So the birth of their son was a miracle to both of them. Abraham's power to be the father was regenerated in him, and Sarah's power to bear a child was given back to her. Now, it's interesting that this, when God switched Abraham back on, he gave him a whole bunch of sons later on after Sarah died. 6 more sons by Keturah. So it's pretty marvelous reversal of nature in an old man to give them the child that was promised. And you remember what the name Isaac means and why, how that came about? Because when the angel of the Lord announced to Abraham and Sarah they were going to have a son in about a year, Sarah laughed and doubted this. Well, Abraham, I'm sure, was full of skepticism too, but God filled his promise and the son Isaac was born. He laughs. So they bore this children, so that the blessing, the miracle was in the lives of both of them. Probably had long discussions and prayer times, and what a delight it was that God finally came through and gave them the promised heir. Therefore, from one man, him as good as dead, Abraham, good as dead. He's age 100, he's going to live to be 175. I'd say that he had a lot of life left in him. if he's as good as dead at 100 and he goes on another 75 years, that makes me want to hold out a little longer here, Doug. From one man and him as good as dead were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude and as innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. Now, why there would be two metaphors different there has always been kind of amazing, unless you stop and think about God promising two groups of people to Abraham. One class of descendants that are as numerous as the stars of the sky, that is a heavenly people, and also another class of people numerous as the sands of the seashore, an earthly people, church and Israel. Then I think you can see very clearly here there's a distinction between church and Israel in the children of Abraham. Abraham has natural descendants who believe in God, who become the heirs to the promised land, and then later in comes the church and we get all these heavenly blessings. So that's what I believe this is all about. All these died in faith. And look at the huge number of children, because we're his children too. And we happen to be mostly his Gentile children. And the Jews then also, the Jewish people, the Jewish nation came out of his son Isaac. And God had promised him that plot of land, by the way. Everywhere you go, the soles of your feet, this land belongs to you. By the time he died, he didn't have any land at all that was in his possession, except he bought one little piece of land in Hebron to bury his wife. And when he died, that's all he had. He didn't have anything, because his hope wasn't in an earthly inheritance at all. It wasn't even in the land. It was a heavenly hope. These all died in faith, not receiving the promises, but having seen them afar off as something that would happen in the future, were assured of them by faith, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. That's pretty neat, because, of course, that's picked up in the New Testament. Peter says the same thing to us. We are strangers and pilgrims in the world, that our aspirations, goals, purpose of living is not in this present life, comfortable though that might be, that we're looking beyond that, that we travel as pilgrims and strangers in the world, not holding on to things, being ready to move, being ready to change our course and direction, strangers and pilgrims passing through. Those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. You begin to be strongly interested in heavenly and eternal things and show very little interest in material things. It's a little bit upsetting to the pagans around you, whose values are always in the world and in the temporal and in the temporary things of the world that are perishing. And we are declaring that we are looking for a homeland as Abraham was. Truly, if they had called to mind, if they'd sat and thought about how good the old days were, if they had thought about the country from which they'd come out, they would have had opportunity to return. Could have moved back to Babylon any time. After coming out of Egypt, they could have gone back to Egypt if they wanted to. You can think about the life you lived before you came to know Jesus, and you could say, well, I guess I could go back and live that if I wanted to. Does it have any appeal to you? Can't you not see the futility of it all and the emptiness and the dullness of it and the end of it all? Who wants to go back? Who wants to turn back once they've had a glimpse of the heavenly country? Now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God. He has prepared a city for them already there. When you die, you'll walk right in those gates into this big heavenly city. It's a Revelation tells us it's 1,500 miles on a side. It could be a cube or a pyramid or a sphere. It's probably a satellite. We get a pretty good description of this marvelous city. If there's a billion people there, you each get one cubic mile, turns out. And we're probably conservative to say a billion people are going to be in heaven if we include all these Old Testament saints. A cubic mile of some kind of a five-dimensional ranch with waterfalls and flowers and stereos and beautiful and marvelous things. And Jesus and all your loved ones and friends and the people you don't like will be over in a distant corner. Well, now I'm distorting something here, but because we can't even begin to imagine how glorious it'll be in a place where there isn't any sin, where everybody you deal with is righteous, and we can trust everybody, and you don't have to be scared, nervous, frightened, you're not going to get betrayed or dumped on or anything. It's pretty awesome to think about. And there's a whole bunch of people that started out on this journey long before we were ever born, and they lived out their whole lives without attaining the goal, just like we may have to do. Okay, we come. It comes back to Abraham by to a later event. Now, Abraham's son is growing up to be 30, 35 years old or so. Ishmael has left the camp. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, "In Isaac your seed shall be called," accounting that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he received him in a figurative sense. Remember that God said to Abraham, "I want you to take your son Isaac," he's living down in Hebron, "I want you to go up 3 days' journey up to Mount Moriah in Jerusalem," wasn't called Jerusalem then, "and I want you to offer your son as a sacrifice on the, what is now the Temple Mount up on Mount Moriah." And God said, "Okay, I'll do that." And you can imagine the conversation on the way up and the obedience of Isaac, who was certainly had to find out something that he was going to end obey his father and be killed. But it tells us very clearly here that Abraham figured out that he might very well have to kill his own son, but that would put God under the obligation of raising that son from the dead, because this is the only son that he had that was the heir, and God couldn't renege on his promise to give him a son. So, all right, I'll take my son's life if I have to, and then God will have to raise him from the dead, so it'll all turn out all right in the long run. So that was how Abraham prepared his heart. They got up to Jerusalem, and of course, at the last moment, the angel of the Lord stepped in and provided an animal sacrifice instead and said to him, "On this mountain it will be provided. On this mountain, at this place, the sacrifice for the sins of mankind will be provided at a future date," which was the angel of the Lord talking about himself. And so that becomes a beautiful picture of the Father's love for the Son and the Son's sacrifice for the world. The Jews make a big fuss out of this so-called binding of Isaac, and there's all kinds of rabbinical stories about it, and it's worth a whole study in and of itself. But Abraham and Isaac had their faith tested at this point. This was the supreme test, of course, for Abraham and the son that he loved and waited for his whole life. Now, in the next generation, we find out that the promise Abraham passed on to Isaac, not Ishmael, passed on to Jacob after that. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau. Esau is the son that didn't believe, that became the father of the Edomites. He gets blessed too, family member. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped leaning on the top of his staff. It's from the Septuagint. The Masoretic doesn't say quite that, but the whole idea would be the patriarchal blessings passing on to the next generation, and then all the way down to Joseph and Egypt and the sons, each of these patriarchs passing the blessing and the promises on down to the next generation. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. Now we get to Moses. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because the Pharaoh was having all the male Hebrew children killed. And so he was hidden 3 months by his parents. They saw that he was a beautiful child, or really, they saw that he was no ordinary child. They were not afraid of the Pharaoh's command to have the children killed. This, they somehow sensed that this boy, Moses, had a calling and a destiny. Of course, all parents think their child is no ordinary child, but here was some special thing from God that said, "We're going to protect this kid." Moses lived 120 years. Remember how his life divides into three 40-year sections. Moses grew up. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, raised by Pharaoh's daughter, raised in the royal court of Pharaoh, could easily have been Secretary of State or Prime Minister, could easily have been an heir to the throne of Egypt because he was adopted into Pharaoh's family, chose rather to suffer ill repute or affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, which is Egypt, which is the world. At that time, the richest, most powerful nation on the world, in the whole world, and also the most idolatrous in all of its polytheism. And Moses, as a young man, renounced that, broke with Pharaoh, identified with his own people, the Jews, to whom he had been born, and chose the affliction the Jews were enduring and put his fate and his lot in with his own people, even though they were in the process of being tormented by the Pharaoh. He esteemed the reproach of Christ. That's pretty interesting. The reproach of Jesus, same kind of reproach. The people of Israel are going to go through the same kind of reproach that Jesus went through. And he thought that was more worth more than all the treasures in Egypt. And he looked to their reward. How is that any different from what we're called to do? To be ridiculed, to be looked down on, to be disfavored, to be passed over for promotions, to be disliked by people around us. The reproach of Jesus. Interesting that it's mentioned that it's Jesus is mentioned way back here in connection with the faith of Moses. By faith, Moses forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. He endured to seeing him who was invisible. Remember that it, how he had to come back and confront the Pharaoh and demand that the people of Israel be let go and risk the wrath of Pharaoh, him, he and Aaron, and how they prevailed and brought the great judgments down on, whole series of judgments down on the Egyptians, and finally the Pharaoh had to let them go. By faith, Moses, kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood. Remember what Passover means. It means to put the blood of the lamb on the doorpost. The angel of destruction will pass over your house. Well, there's the picture of this old covenant thing again about your sins being covered and you are protected from the judgment of God, and because God's going to pass over you. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. So the destroying angel went through the whole land, killed all the firstborn, but the Jews who kept the Passover had divine protection. Perfect picture of how faith operates. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians attempting to do so were drowned. Egyptian history shows very little evidence of this happening, and the Egyptians were too proud to put this in hieroglyphics on their tombs. But there's no question about what this happened. Pharaoh and his army came into the sea and were drowned. I think about probably 1400 or 1500 BC would be my date. Or the secular scholars are all moving this date down to 1200, and I think that's too soon. That's not quite right. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down. Take a big jump here. We go through the whole up to the conquest of the land by Joshua. And the people of Israel going across the River Jordan and then marching around this Canaanite city of Joshua six times plus seven times, 13 times around the city, and then shouting, and then the walls of Jericho falling down. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. It's the obedience of faith that caused God to move to pull the walls down. Mighty act of energy and power in response to the simple faith of foolishly marching around 7 days. Some of the Jews in Jerusalem wanted to march around the Temple Mount seven times and see if that would work, but get the mosque, the Dome of the Rock off of the top of the Temple Mount, and it might work, but there's nothing specific that we can count on. So it's also hard to march around the Temple Mount right now because it isn't easy to encircle, but still, you see what's happening here. Insurmountable stronghold of evil is conquered by the simple faith of God's people who do what he says. Awful stupid looking. Do this. There was one woman living in the city who was a prostitute. Her name was Rahab. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish with those who did not believe. With all the unbelieving Canaanites in her city, she believed God when she had received the spies with peace. So Joshua sent spies into the city. Rahab showed them hospitality. She says, "Oh, I'm interested in your God." And the spies said, "Will you get you and your family and all your friends and come in and we'll get you out of here before the city is destroyed?" And Rahab obeyed. I don't know how many of her family did. But she becomes a believer, becomes a proselyte to Israel, enters into the covenant with Israel, is actually married into the family line of Jesus himself. So, a pretty neat story of Rahab. Shows that God's mercy extends all the time out into the world around about. And this one woman in Jericho, Rahab, is highly honored for her faith. And her faith caused her to risk her life in hiding the spies. And in a way, she's a traitor to the Canaanites, but they were all unbelieving. So, interesting. What more shall I say? Time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson, of Jephthah, of David and Samuel, and the prophets. We'll go through all the book of Judges here and on down through Samuel, the first of the prophets and the last of the judges, And we're going to get on down through the whole history of Israel. And the writer here is sort of overwhelmed with all the people, all the men and women down through the history of Israel now who have acted by faith. And here's what they did. By their faith, they did all kinds of things. They subdued kingdoms. Joshua and the conquest. They worked righteousness. I mean, morality and justice and integrity and good government and so on. They obtained promises from God. Stopped the mouths of lions. Daniel and the lion's den. Quenched the violence of fire. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the burning fiery furnace of Nebuchadnezzar. Out of weakness were made strong. Became valiant in battle against overwhelming numbers. Turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Stopped foreign invasions. Turned them back. Again, usually against overwhelming odds. Women received their dead back to life again. Elisha, Elijah, Jesus, all restoring to women their widowed women or single women, their children who died. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourging and chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. Sawn in two is probably Isaiah. In a hollow log, according to Josephus. They were tempted, slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and caves, in dens, in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. Now, these are Old Testament believers who were persecuted for their faith. This is not Fox's Book of Martyrs. If you read Fox's Book of Martyrs and see what the early Christians went through, it scared the daylights out of you, the blood and the violence and the suffering and the hardship that early Christians suffered, or the Christians in our own day and age have had to suffer in some parts of the world. If you'll pick up Book of Maccabees and read about the deeds of the Maccabees in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, if you look at things that happened in the Old Testament, there's plenty of terrible persecution and violence and cruelty towards the believing people. Sometimes in Israel, you get a handful of believers and most of the people in the nation are the enemies of the believers. It's true in Israel right now today. You have a handful of righteous people and the book of the nation is secular and anti-God still to this day. So there's this, all sorts of things may happen to you because of your faith in Jesus. We are so insulated from the suffering that so much of the Christian community has gone through or is going through that this all seems foreign to us. As Elaine Sedman pointed out once, persecution and hard times could come upon the church even suddenly in our day and age. It wouldn't take too much to change the whole times that we live in. Just happen to be under a lot of grace right now. All these people, all these saints, having obtained a good testimony, God's very pleased with them in their faith, honors their faith, having received a good testimony through faith, did not receive what was promised. Isn't that interesting? You can go all the way to your grave and never see your greatest dreams and hopes realized. And is that the end of the story? Well, it certainly is not. That's when the payback comes. That's when God starts. When you die is when God's going to start honoring your faith in the next generation, in the next, in the next. So you can leave a legacy that goes on long after you're gone. And all these saints did not receive what was promised, God having provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. Well, that's pretty interesting that all these pilgrims on this big journey in the Old Testament are going to arrive in the new city when we get there, and we're all going to get there at the same time, and what a surprise they're going to have. They all think that they are the ones, that they're the ones that are going to this new heavenly city, and all of a sudden there's this other group of people that shows up, and what a surprise they're going to have. And we'll know all about them, and they won't know a thing about us, and we'll have to have this big get-together party and introduce ourselves. And we ask them questions about their lives that we didn't read about in the Bible. So it's going to be pretty awesome. They, apart from us, they should not be made perfect. So we're all going to arrive there at this grand city all at once, this great, big, diverse people, all of whom are characterized by faith, from all over the world. Now, this is pretty much apart from churches, denominations, synagogues. You see, the really key thing in here is your faith and trust in God. That's what the bottom line is here. The risk, the commitment, the willingness to take steps out and trust God for hard and difficult things, impossible things. Okay?